So while I was traveling, I had two books with me. And one is The Essence of the Heart Sutra by the Dalai Lama. Very excellent. And the other one was From Here to Enlightenment, which is just this amazing teachings that he gave at Lehigh University on the stages to the path to enlightenment. Tsongkhapa wrote this humongous volume on the stages of the path to enlightenment. And it's part of this interesting class of literature that the Tibetans kind of got from the Indians, which is what I call a cookbook, which is like, you know, if you follow all these stages, you don't get Vishiswa, you get a Buddha. You know, I made Vishiswa for lunch. So, I mean, it's very systematic because, you know, the scholars in the ancient Indian universities had it worked out. You know, this is what the problem is. These are the antidotes that you apply to the problems, and these are the consequences of doing this. Then stage by stage, this is how you move through things. And you start being ordinary, confused disaster, and you end up being a Buddha. And so it's a very unique form of literature. And Tsongkhapa, who's 14th century in Tibet, who really kind of founded the lineage of what became the Dalai Lamas and all of that tradition. So he'd written this incredible tome on this, and several years ago when His Holiness was at Lehigh University, sort of at an event that celebrated the translation of the third of the three volumes of the great path, the great stages of the path of liberation, they'd finished translating and publishing it. So they were celebrating that, and he did a systematic overview. And it's a small book, it's only 100 and some pages, 120 pages, but it's just unbelievably. I mean, Dalai Lama, you know, when he decides to do a Dharma talk, it just the stuff he says just is unbelievable. And so this is one of them. I heard him teaching at Harvard in 1983, I think it was. Give or take a year, and he had been asked to come, and the organizers said, "Well, what do you want to teach?" And he said, "Well, I can teach something that people have heard, or I can teach something that no one has heard. We'll go for that." So I remember sitting in the audience, and of course I was younger at the time, so these things happen. I remember sitting in the audience, and he'd go through this line of analysis of something. And when he reached the conclusion, it was like I'd have an orgasm. It was like the beauty of his analysis was just, you know, like I'd have this mental orgasm is the only thing I could say. He just has the most amazing mind. So you see that in that book, and it's also in this. But the reason I mention all of this is while I was on this trip, I read a passage in the Heart Sutra that just kind of stopped me in my tracks. And I wanted to share that with you. And I wanted to talk about that and what it means, and maybe work with that theme for a while. We'll see how far we get with that. I don't think one night's talk we're going to be finished with it. And what the Heart Sutra is one of the small versions of the class of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. They're the Buddhist Mahayana Buddhist teachings about the nature of reality. They're the wisdom teachings. They're about the mind which understands what's really going on, either intellectually or through direct perception. Okay, so they're very critical, and they're what distinguishes, one of the things that distinguishes Mahayana Buddhism from Theravada or Hinayana Buddhism, which we now know as more in south of Asia in the 20th century. And Mahayana was more in the north, but anyhow, without getting into those distinctions. So the Heart Sutra is one of the most revered of the teachings because it's very pithy. And often His Holiness will begin his teachings with a recitation of the Heart Sutra. Whatever he's teaching, there'll be that. If you go to a Chinese monastery, they'll be chanting the Heart Sutra. And so one of the things that for some period of time His Holiness was doing when he'd have these teachings that he would do on whatever the subject would be, a lot of different monks and nuns from different traditions would show up. So he'd have them chant the Heart Sutra. So the Tibetan monks would chant and nuns would chant the Heart Sutra, and the Chinese monks and nuns would chant the Heart Sutra in Chinese, and the Vietnamese would do it in Vietnamese. If the Koreans were there, they'd do it in Korean. And he was basically trying to say, you know, all these different cultures, languages, history, but we have these things in common, and we need to respect all of this. So they would chant it. It was always so interesting to hear the different ways these different cultures would chant the same thing, you know, because their language is being different. And you can hear these things. You can go online. You can hear the Heart Sutra chanted in all these different languages if you want. There are websites, heartsutra.org or things like that. You know, and you just listen to these things. And it's quite extraordinary. Anyhow, there is a passage in the Heart Sutra which His Holiness comments on. And he comments on the subject of nirvana. And I realized that in the 4 years that I've been teaching here in Le Grand, the word nirvana has probably never come out of my mouth. I've talked about liberation, and I've talked about enlightenment. And liberation is similar to nirvana, but it's different in some ways. And one of the things that's interesting to me is that I was thinking about in preparing this talk is that when we talk about liberation, we think we know what we're talking about. We think we know what liberation means. It's a good English word. We know what it means. It's like, you know, get out of jail free, you're liberated. Liberation, right? And this center was named by Denma Lhotse Rinpoche as, you know, basically place or center for finding the path to liberation. It was his choice of a name. So I've talked about liberation. But the problem when you talk about liberation, people probably think they know what it means. But when you talk about nirvana, people probably think they know what it means too, but deep down inside, I think we know we don't know what it means. We don't really know what nirvana is. There's a perfume called nirvana, which has got to be the opposite of what nirvana actually is, right? Because it's designed to entice the opposite gender. It's not very nirvana. Well, maybe for some people, but not for Buddhists anyway. There's a perfume titled opium, called opium too, you know. That's at least honest. Yeah. So, what is nirvana? So, technically, the way nirvana is described in one of the Buddhist sutras, one of the old Pali sutras, the Buddha says it's the blowing out. It's like the blowing out of a flame. It's the cooling of cravings. He says it's like the blowing out of a flame. That's nirvana. I think of nirvana as being like peace. Peace which is incomprehensible. But that's just the way I think about it. The thing about nirvana is, whatever it is, it's not something that can be grasped at conceptually, because conceptuality is one of the things that keeps you from experiencing it. Conceptuality, which is to say mentally constructing representations of the world, rather than experiencing what's actually going on, is one of the things that keeps you from having any peace. And there's nothing wrong with mentally constructing representations of the world, but when you believe those things and you're caught up by those things, and those things, you know, generate cravings, aversions, delusions, you know, those things don't generate peace. That's not part of peace. Peace, from the Buddhist point of view, nirvana, from the Buddhist point of view, is something that happens when conceptuality stops and mental representations stop, and you enter into a space which is not conceptualized. You enter into a consciousness which is a direct experience of what's really going on, which is actually what the perfection of wisdom is. The perfection of wisdom is a condition of consciousness which is aware of what's actually happening directly and unmediated by concepts. So this passage that I read, which struck me as being very important, I'm going to read the whole thing, and then I'll... the first thing that I'll read is the actual section from the Heart Sutra, which His Holiness comments on, and then I'll comment on His comments. And then, depending upon where things go off in the future, you know, we may kind of get back at more stuff in the Heart Sutra. So let me just read this. If you get the book, it's on page 127, under the section called Attaining the Result, and the subsection is called Nirvana. And again, this is Essence of the Heart Sutra by the Dalai Lama. So the text then reads, so now I'm quoting, "Therefore Shariputra," who is one of the disciples of the Buddha, so the two of the disciples of the Buddha are talking to each other. So, "Therefore Shariputra, since bodhisattvas have no attainments, they rely on this perfection of wisdom and abide in it. Having no obscuration in their minds," which is no conceptuality, "they have no fear. And by going utterly beyond error, they will reach the end of nirvana." Now, okay, but it was his commentary that really zapped me. And so what his commentary is, in the context of the Heart Sutra, we understand nirvana to be the ultimate nature of one's mind at a stage when the mind has become totally cleansed of all mental afflictions. As we have seen earlier, it is because the mind is innately pure, which is to say it has Buddha nature, that simply removing the obscurations to clarity reveals enlightenment. Thus, the emptiness of the mind is said to be the basis of nirvana, its natural nirvana. When an individual goes through a process of purifying the mind by applying the antidotes to the mental afflictions, over time, the mind becomes totally free of all these obscurations. The emptiness of this undefiled mind is the true nirvana, or liberation. And this is also sometimes called non-abiding nirvana, and I'll go into this a bit more. Thus, one can attain liberation, true nirvana, only through actualizing the ultimate nature of the mind in its perfect and unafflicted state. So let me tell you why that zapped me so much, because it probably isn't zapping you. But the reason for this is that, you know, often here I've talked about the difference between appearance and reality. And I said, appearances are what's happening here. It's the conventional world we live in, which we need to live in. I mean, we have to live in the conventional world to earn a living, drive a car, you know, pay the bills, all that kind of stuff that we do for our ordinary life. But that's a constructed world. And we could say that it's constructed through linguistic and social conventions as we're growing up and so on and so forth. It's certainly not the world that newborn babies live in. They live in a different world, which is like, whoa, what's going on here? There's no conceptuality. It's like, whatever. But we live in a constructed world. But the reality is, when you withdraw the projections, the constructions from your experience of all the different senses, the constructions of sounds, the constructions of, like, this sound means something, or this sound bothers me, like the dog across the street. You know, that's not just a dog bark. That's an irritating dog bark because I've been listening to it for 3 years. It's like there's something else that's layered over that dog bark. You know, if it was just a dog barking, it wouldn't be so much trouble. Or the things we see, you know. I mean, I look at a tree, and a tree could be beautiful, but I label it as a tree, and immediately some thoughts come up about the tree. And if it happens to be a tree on my property, then when I look at the tree, it's not just a tree anymore. It's a tree which needs trimming. Or it's a tree that is dropping stuff on the lawn. It's like there's all this other stuff that's added on to tree-ness. Okay? When you withdraw all that stuff, when you empty your experience, that's the meaning of emptiness, when you empty your experiences of all your concepts and projections and attractions and repulsions about all the different elements of experience, and you're just there with what's there, whatever that is, that's the emptiness of phenomena. And that's what's referred to as natural nirvana. And it's called natural nirvana because the reality of things is they're totally at peace. I mean, the reality is everything is just flowing along very peacefully. Right? You know, the problem is that our grasping at things in our mind is like, you know, constructs things and rigidifies that natural flow. It's like dropping big boulders in the stream and you get rapids, right? You get white water. And that's what we experience. But natural nirvana is the reality of what things are. They're totally at peace already. Now, the reason it's important to me is, as a scholar of Nagarjuna and somebody who's been studying emptiness for years, you know, it's sort of like I spend a lot of time looking at things and thinking about what it means for them to be empty, you know, trying to identify projections, trying to identify the way in which my own grasping or aversions transforms the appearance of things, and that I react to my projecting into the situation rather than reacting to the situation as it actually is. And so I really try and draw a distinction between those two things. And usually I fail, of course. But, you know, I make the effort, and that's what Buddhist practice is about, is making the effort to get into reality apart from your own projections onto reality, knowing that your projections are there and seeing them as such. And sometimes that's described as the difference between sitting on the meditation cushion and being off the meditation cushion. Because when you're sitting on the meditation cushion, you can actually try and be in what's there without thinking of, well, hopefully without thinking about the bills, but, you know, just like be in the space that you're in reality. However you get to that through various kinds of meditation. When you get off the cushion, of course, you're back into conventional reality, you're back into constructs, and they're necessary, although, as the Buddhists say, still, you can understand that they're constructs when you're busy engaged with them. They talk about living in the illusion-like world and knowing it's the illusion-like world, which is to say, okay, here we are. You know, we're in the illusion-like world. We've got to play this game together, and we know that, so that's fine. But we're going to recognize illusion as illusion and that we're living in it. And then we go back on the meditation cushion, and we say, okay, no more illusion. Let's get into reality. Okay, so you flip-flop back and forth between the two. So when you're sitting on the meditation cushion, what you're seeking then is an understanding of reality, and you're seeking to understand and to experience natural nirvana, that kind of peace that comes from just allowing things to flow without grasping onto them or being repelled by them or trying to understand them even, because your mind is going to try and understand things and your mind will be deluded in the way in which it tries to understand the reality of things, you know. I mean, your mind won't be deluded about the conventional nature of things. I mean, the conventional nature of a dirty dish is a dirty dish. It takes soap to wash it. That's reality, you know, conventional reality. The ultimate reality of that dirty dish is a whole other matter. The ultimate reality of that dirty dish is just whatever is there. Dirt doesn't mean anything in particular. You know, I mean, it's a constructed phenomenon, and it has no particular significance one way or the other. But the reason it struck me was when he was talking about what happens when you spend time looking at or trying to reach into or experience natural nirvana. That what comes out of that is a transformation of the mind through that process of of seeking to experience, not conceptualize, but seeking to experience the emptiness of things, seeking to experience the natural nirvana of phenomena. Phenomena as perhaps the plants experience things. I won't say the animals, because most animals are attracted or repelled by various aspects of existence. But if plants were conscious, and maybe they are, I don't know, they probably experience natural nirvana. They're attracted to the sun, but they don't mind the moon. They like it to be damp, but I don't think they freak out too much when it's not, you know, this kind of thing. They're kind of peaceful. Maybe that's just my fantasy. Anyway, but when you seek to experience natural nirvana, what happens is you're constantly not being caught by the habit patterns of attraction, repulsion, and delusion. You're not, because you're sitting on the meditation cushion, you just let that stuff go by. It's like a thought comes up, rather than trailing after the thought, thinking, got to pay the bills. It's like, no, that thought's going to go away. The bills will get paid later. I'm not even going to think about it. How much do I owe Visa? I'm not even going to think about it. Psh, that goes by. You know, not caught by that. Not into, oh, wow, there's some really nice, you know, Marionberry pie in the fridge, and I'm thinking, I'd really like to have some. It's like, nope. It's there, it's in the fridge, but I'm not going to be into that right now, you know. So it's like when attractions and repulsions come up, you don't react to them. And because you don't react to them, the habit patterns of that particular attraction or that particular repulsion are weakened. You know, it's like my favorite metaphor is cigarette smoking. Because I used to smoke cigarettes. And what I realized when I tried to stop smoking, which was extremely difficult, I mean, I quit smoking cigarettes about 40 or 50 times, right? But I finally did stop the 50th time or whatever it was. Because what I realized was, in every moment, you have a choice to either take a puff or not. And every time you take a puff, it reinforces the habit of smoking, and then you're going to smoke more. And every time you don't, it reinforces the habit of not smoking, and then you're less likely to smoke. And so that was, when I realized that, that was the way I quit smoking, was in every moment I realized I had a choice, and that the more choices I made to not smoke, the more likely I was to not smoke. That's what worked for me. So it became a great metaphor for understanding what Buddhists mean by these compulsions of attraction and repulsion, which is to say, if you stop reacting to them, then they're weakened, whether it's attraction or repulsion. It doesn't matter whether it's for good things, bad things, or neutral things. It doesn't make any difference. In the context of meditation, the whole idea is to develop independence of your own mind and your own compulsions, at least while you're sitting on the meditation cushion. Then you get up and run to the icebox and run to the fridge and have the pie, right? But while you're sitting there, nada, okay? Okay. And the more often you're sitting there and you're not doing it, the less likely that when you get up from the meditation cushion, you're going to run to the refrigerator and have the pie. Not that there's anything wrong with pie, but I've already had 2 pieces of pie today, so probably don't. The third one is probably not a good thing. Right? So, and then in regards to delusion, the third of the poisons, it's sort of like, you know, when you believe your thoughts, that's when you're deluded. And so it's okay to be deluded in the world of conventional reality because everyone's deluded. That's how we get along together. We share our big delusions and it functions relatively well, and that's how the world works. But when you're sitting on the meditation cushion, it's like, no, that thought was delusion. Like, I'm not even going to believe that thought. You know, it doesn't matter what the thought is, good, bad, or indifferent. I'm not going to believe it, except the thoughts that I choose to use for a meditation theme. Those I'll take seriously, right? Because I'm going to use those thoughts as antidotes to negative thoughts. Now, here the example actually comes out of the Hindu tradition. The example that I like is something Ramakrishna said, who's a 19th century Bengali saint. In that period of time, a lot of people walked around barefoot. They didn't have sandals, certainly didn't have shoes. And he said, so like, you know, if you're a sannyasi, a yogi walking in the jungle, and you step on a thorn, and the thorn is in your foot, how do you get it out? Well, you get another thorn and use it to pick out the thorn that's in your foot. That's how you get it out. Like we would use a tweezers or a needle or something, then you get another thorn. Use a second thorn to get the first thorn out, and then you throw them both away. So the thoughts or the meditation themes that we use intentionally when we're meditating, that's like the second thorn to get the first thorn out. Of course, you want to throw them both away when you can, right? So you use delusion, you use constructed thought as an antidote to constructed thought, right? So, you know, the kind of constructed thoughts that bother us are things like, I'm so great, the world revolves around me. So there are, you know, there are 8 of us in this room right now, and each one of us thinks we're the center of the cosmos. I guarantee it, right? There are no 8 centers of the cosmos in this room. It doesn't work that way, right? There are no centers to the cosmos, right? And there certainly aren't 8. And if there were even one, it wouldn't be one of us sitting in this room for sure, right? And yet every one of us knows with absolute certitude we're the center of the cosmos, right? So that's the first thorn as an example, right? So the second thorn is to say, okay, great. So I'm going to imagine that center of the cosmos that I am as a Buddha, who actually happens to be the center of the cosmos. And that will be an antidote to the first thorn. That's a thumbnail for why we do the practice that we do, thumbnail sketch for why we do the practice that we do. We do things that are intentional antidotes, understanding that they're fictions, but that they're useful fictions, unlike the unuseful fictions that mostly drive us. We're going to choose some useful, helpful fictions. Or to use another example of medicine, you know. Certain kinds of medications, if you just took them, would be bad for you. But if you happen to be ill, they're good for you. And when you don't need them anymore, you stop taking them, you know. Like, what's the super-duper antibiotic? Zithromycin or something?
Oh, is it erythromycin?
It's not erythromycin, because that's at the A level. This is at the Z level. Way out there. Yeah. Like when you're super sick, this is what the doctor prescribes. Right. And it wipes out everything, unfortunately, including all the bacteria and stuff you need in your body. Right? You wouldn't want to take it on a daily basis. It would be really bad for you, but if you happen to be really sick, it's good for you. And then you stop taking it when you're supposed to stop taking it, right? So all these things we do are like antidotes to things we want to be rid of. But we don't want to get attached to them, right? Because they're just another mental construction, okay? But the point is, you work with these antidotes so that you can experience things as they actually are, the emptiness of things, which is, say, the non-constructed reality of what it is, the natural nirvana, and what happens. Then you achieve what's called non-abiding nirvana. So what's the difference? The difference is, when we get up off the meditation cushion, we're meditating on natural nirvana, the emptiness of phenomena. We get up off the meditation cushion, and we're right back in the mess that we're always in, right? So the only place we find any peace is we go sit on the meditation cushion. As soon as we get off the meditation cushion, it's all that craziness again, no peace, right? But when you work through these processes so that you can experience the non-abiding nirvana, the true nirvana His Holiness was talking about. When you're sitting on the meditation cushion, you get up off the meditation cushion, nirvana. Doesn't matter whether you're sitting on the cushion or you're in the world, it's nirvana. Because you've cooled all that confusion. You've cooled the false attractions to things. You've cooled the false repulsions to things. You're in reality, and you're comfortable with reality. And conceptuality may occur, but you see it for what it is, and it doesn't catch you anymore. Attractions may arise, but you see them for what they are, and they don't control you anymore. Repulsions may arise, you see them for what they are, you don't reject them anymore. Or as the sutra says, there's no more fear, because you know what things really are, and you know what you are, and there's nothing to be afraid of because there's no fundamental difference between the you and the it. Right? So that's what I got from reading this. And the other thing that struck me about it is, I think you know, that Kay and I basically have practiced both in the Zen traditions and in the Tibetan tradition. In the Zen tradition, they don't talk very intentionally about applying the antidotes. Like green Tara meditation. That's an antidote, right? In Zen, they talk about meditating by emptying your mind and not allowing yourself to be caught by thoughts. But that is an antidote, but they don't talk about it as if it's an antidote, right? And in Zen, there's this tendency for people to kind of slip into this sort of state of not being caught by the poisons of attraction, repulsion, and neutrality, or delusion rather, attraction, repulsion, and delusion, sort of slip into that state, but not understanding fully that it's a state which is intended as an antidote, and sort of getting stuck in a state of no thought, in a state of no action, and a state of potential confusion. As our teacher, Tara Rinpoche, said to the Zen meditators at Green Gulch Zen Center, he said, if you're sitting and meditating and you get up and you can't read the newspaper with complete clarity, there's something wrong with your meditation. And we knew a lot of people who were kind of getting stuck in that kind of heavy, non-intellectual, non-conceptual, you know, kind of like sinking stuff, which they thought was achieving something in meditation. So it's sort of like they were seeking natural nirvana without understanding that unless they also pursued non-abiding or true nirvana, they were going to constantly come out of their practice and get caught by all that stuff, because they weren't intentionally applying antidotes to the stuff, because they saw the antidotes as just more delusion, so forget about that. They didn't understand the two thorns way of thinking about the antidotes. And so that struck me really strongly and sort of clarified something that I'd seen in Zen, because Zen is a very powerful practice when done correctly. And so I'm not being critical of Zen. It's a very advanced practice. But I think many people practice without understanding fully how to do the practice in a way which is most fruitful, and that there are some dangers in that. Just as there are dangers in the Tibetan practice of not understanding that the antidote is just an antidote. You know, it's sort of like Tibetans, for example, are constantly, native Tibetans, are constantly getting stuck in their relationship with, say, protector deities, or attachment to bodhisattvas like Tara, you know, like, please take care of me, Tara. I can't take care of myself. You take care of me, kinds of things, without understanding that Tara is an aspect of themselves, that the protectors, you know, are powers in the universe, which in a sense are aspects of themselves, but are certainly not elements to be fully focusing your practice on. So the Tibetans, native Tibetans, tend toward the fault of absolutism or reification of the antidote or the deities. And the Zen practitioners tend to fall toward the extreme of non-reification, or in fact nihilism, of like nothing in particular, nothing at all. And the truth of the matter of practice and reality is someplace, as the Buddha says, between the two extremes. And so this distinction between the natural nirvana and the non-abiding, that is to say, the Buddha does not abide in anything, the non-abiding nirvana or the true nirvana, really struck me as being very important. And that's what I wanted to share with you tonight. And perhaps a theme through the Heart Sutra that we'll work with a bit more.